court is now in session.
Karen Conti's going to host Brian Noonan's show Sunday from 6 to 9. We have several things to jump to. But first, Karen, since we talk about the law here, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
I wanted to congratulate the legislators of Nevada for taking charge of their state and putting into play a rule that I think we need in Illinois and around the country. And that law is this. It is now illegal to drive less than the speed limit in the left lane on any road in Nevada. Huh? Right?
Good.
You like it? You like it?
Standing ovation.
Yes.
Prostitution is legal, but driving slow in the left lane, illegal.
Well, think about it. How will you get to the prostitutes if you're going to dilly-dally?
What?
You got to pick it up. You got to speed.
There you go.
You should not be in the left lane driving 45 miles an hour in a 55 or Amen. In some cases worse. I mean, you can make it an unsafe situation because people are impatient. And by the way, I'm one of them.
I agree.
Well, and you know what's interesting? A lot of states have laws. You know, some of them just say that you can't use that lane unless you're turning or passing. Many states already have that law. So this is not a new thing. But what's really interesting, if you look into accidents, and I've had a little experience in my legal career dealing with accidents, is that the stats are that if you're going 5 miles per hour slower than traffic around you, despite whether you're breaking the law or not, you are much more likely to get into an accident than if you're going 5 miles per hour faster than traffic.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
This is a safety issue for sure.
All right. Let's move on to the president, who had another delightful day as POTUS. There is now significant reason to believe, because it's been verified by a bunch of people, including the White House, that there's a grand jury that's been impaneled by Robert Mueller's folks specifically to deal with Trump Jr.'s meeting of June 2016 with the Russian attorney and her posse, or would it be posse ski, with her people. What does this mean, starting with explain what a grand jury does?
A grand jury can do a lot of things. It sits in it. It can issue subpoenas. It can listen to witnesses. It can compel witnesses to come and testify if they don't want to do that voluntarily. And, you know, they basically will end up at some point deciding whether or not a charge should be brought. They're not deciding guilt or innocence. They're just deciding whether or not there's enough evidence to charge somebody, whether there was a crime committed, first of all, and then who did it, and was there enough evidence to convict that person. So it's a tool used by a prosecutor to get information. You know, we shouldn't read too much into this. It's a lot of people are jumping to the conclusion that, oh, there's evidence and he's guilty. It's not really that way. I think Mueller knows what he's doing as far as using tools that he has, and this is the next step in getting to the bottom of what he's been charged to do.
The grand jury cliche is a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich, meaning that grand juries are impaneled to find enough evidence to go forward in a trial. Do you subscribe to that theory?
Absolutely. There's no defense there. You know, the defense lawyers don't get to be there. The defendant, potential defendant, doesn't get to be there. So it is a star chamber where the prosecutor puts on all of his evidence as to what happened, and there's no other side to it. So the grand jury usually does indict. Now, it doesn't always do that. I believe in the Drew Peterson case, the grand jury, at least at first, did not decide to go forward with it. So, you know, it all depends on what the evidence is. And another interesting part of this is that Mueller chose a court in an area that is a highly Democratic area, where 90% of the people voted for Hillary Clinton. So let's just say there are charges brought at some point. You know, this is a place where the jury would be largely Democrats. Interesting, because the guy is not political, but I think the choice really makes it, I don't know, I guess if you're looking down the line, this would not bode well for a President Trump or one of his sons to be charged.
It certainly gives him something more to complain about.
Karen, if the grand jury, if the grand jury doesn't find enough evidence to move forward with the case, can Mueller still, or Mueller rather, still say, you know what, I disagree and pursue it? Or is it once the grand jury speaks, that's it?
He could do it with other means. But my guess would be that he wouldn't do that because this is such a public deal. I think that he would want a grand jury, a separate body, to be able to say, we looked at the evidence objectively, we were called from the community, and we collectively decided that there was enough evidence to charge. I don't think he would do that, but he could conceivably do that.
The thing that you said that kind of struck with me, with because I've never gone through the grand jury process, is that those grand jurors could ask questions themselves and that the defense attorney can't be in the room. So since this is sworn testimony under oath that could be used and referred to and is used and referred to later if there's a trial, that's a lot of pressure for the people that are testifying, right?
Well, it is, and a lot of them choose not to, or they'll take the Fifth. Yes, their testimony, you're sworn when you go into the grand jury, so anything you say during that time can be used against you or used to impeach your credibility in the real trial. It's a very powerful means, and the jurors get to see all kinds of stuff that, like in a regular trial, you know, we have these rules of evidence, hearsay, these kinds of things that keep a lot of evidence out. In the grand jury, there's really no rules about that. So the jury gets to see things that might even be hearsay and things that normally wouldn't be admissible into evidence. So they have a very broad spectrum. They're almost an investigative tool at that time rather than a guilty, innocent kind of tool. People confuse it because, of course, the jury that decides a regular case, it really is nothing like that. That body decision makers. They're deciding and investigating whether or not there is a crime.
So we don't know if this is going to amount to anything, but we do know it's not great news for Trump.
No, and his lawyer came out and said, I thought it was a good statement. He said, you know, we're looking to get to the bottom of this, too, and we welcome it. Now, I'm not sure if President Trump is going to say the same thing in his tweets, but that was a statement that should be made by his lawyer that, you know, they have no way to stop this from going on, although I understand that there was talk that Trump maybe was considering trying to get Mueller out, and I think that the Senate is not going to let that happen. But you know, he's got a dream team of investigators. He's got fraud investigators. He's got scholars. He's got a really, you know, blue chip panel there. And this investigation is going to be done correctly. And we're going to get to the bottom of it one way or the other.
Robert Mueller's behind closed doors. He's got to be like John Wayne in the old days. Yeah. Just walking, talking cool. And you're just waiting for him to come swing the saloon doors open and arrest you.
Well, he's a great guy. I mean, he was appointed by George W. Bush. He was extended by Barack Obama. He's the longest serving FBI director other than Hoover. He's got a Purple Heart from the Marines. You know, he's highly educated, Princeton, University of Virginia. I mean, this guy is, you know, he's a good guy. He's a bipartisan. He's Republican to start with, but he's served under both parties. And I think he's the right guy to do his job.
That's an education thing. I think Karen just brought up was a shot at me because she knows I'm an Ithaca College dropout. It's not a dropout, no. Karen. It's a leave of absence. I can go back at any time. They never expire. It's 6:50. We'll get traffic. We'll come back. Got a couple more issues to take up with Karen, including the sentencing of the young woman who encouraged her boyfriend to kill himself. How much time did she get, if any? And now this. Karen Conti, attorney at law for whom? That'd be your cue, Karen, to plug your business.
Oh, it might help.
Oh.
Actually stuck. There we go. Yes, go ahead. The cue for the plug is on.
If you want to call me, it's 312-332-7800 or email me at kconti@kcontilaw.com.
All right, so this young woman inexplicably gets tired of hearing her boyfriend talk about his depression. And then starts to challenge him that he doesn't have the guts to do it, and then encourages him to do it, and he kills himself. She was sentenced to what?
She was sentenced to 2.5 years, but only 15 months would be served, or the rest would be suspended, and then she would be on probation for a period of 5 years.
I don't know how I feel about this. I'll be honest. I think she's a horrible person. I have no idea how much misery she has or hatred she has. And she needs a lot of help. But this is, to me, obviously it's sentenced, so it's a precedent-setting situation, and I guess it's a great message to send. But I know we've had cases in the past where there have been bullies, adult bullies who've bullied children. There was a woman in St. Louis who, for some reason, didn't like the girl that lived next door. I don't know if she mean to her daughter or something, and cyber-bullied that girl to a point where she ended up taking her own life. So I know this stuff goes on. But I don't know. I guess I have misgivings about the fact that he killed himself and she's going to jail, even though it seems like that's where she ought to be.
Yeah, and, you know, in some ways I would really like to just get into her head and have her say, what were you thinking at this time? Because, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, the bottom line here is that a lot of people don't know, but we have laws, most of the states have laws that make it a crime to induce someone to commit suicide, Illinois included. And so if you did this in Illinois, this would probably be a crime. You know, under the code, it'd be a class 2 felony. But in this state, there was no such law, and so they had to use the manslaughter law, which is basically acting in a reckless manner to cause harm in a way that you know that someone is going to cause harm to themselves. And the kind of the pivotal point was the kid was getting out of the car, and it looked like maybe he was going to extricate himself from it. And at that point, she said to him, get back in the car. And I think that's what the prosecutors hung their hat on, that he was getting away from it. He was showing an intent not to kill himself, and she coerced him to come back. And that was reckless enough to say, for the judge to say, that this is a crime. You know, it's very interesting, but it's also a First Amendment issue. When does something you say become a crime? You know, when does it cross that line?
Karen, that's what I was going to ask you, too. First Amendment issue. And does this set kind of a dangerous precedent? Because what if you send a joking text to say Steve Cochran or Dave Ennett, whatever it might be? Oh, terrible day. You know, go jump off the Michigan Avenue Bridge. And they actually do. I mean, how are they going to be able to discern what's a joke? What's serious? Is this a dangerous precedent?
I think it is in some ways, because let's just say that the person you send that email to, you know, is very sensitive, and you know is very subject, you know, to, you know, not liking criticism, and you know he's got depression problems. And so you sent that joke knowing that maybe he would act on it. I don't know. Where does that line get drawn? And then there's also the idea that, you know, people who commit suicide, you know, have control over what they're doing. They're mentally ill. There's no question about that. And you can't explain that either. But, you know, you do have to say that that is a person who is probably predisposed to do it anyway. So what is the straw that breaks the camel's back? I think it is a dangerous precedent. I think we're going to see more cases like this that are going to test the boundaries.
Has she ever answered to what she was thinking, the question you brought up?
I don't think she has publicly, and her lawyers would obviously want to keep her out of that media arena. But, you know, I'm hoping someday we hear this, because I would like to hear. You know, young people are wired differently. We know that. And
well, this kid needs a lot of help. These calls went on for a period of time, and like you said, he gets out of the truck. She tells him to get back in. And then afterwards, the way she acted, where it seemed like she was enjoying the drama of being the girlfriend of the victim and blah, blah, blah. You know, it seems like a mental institution is where this kid ought to be, not jail.
Well, and I think that's what the judge has to do. She was a juvenile offender, but she was charged as an adult. But when you sentence a juvenile, the judge really has to put on high priority, we want to rehabilitate this person, because this person, you know, is a young person, you know, with the right counseling, perhaps she's going to get better and not do this again. And that's the key. If she were an older person, I would guess that she would have had a much longer sentence. But she's going to get mental health treatment. There's no question about that before they're going to let her off probation. You know, it reminds me of that other case with the kids watching the man drown and texting and taking pictures and not reporting the death. You know, you wonder what's going on in their head. Is it just a bunch of young kids with bad impulse control, or is it just some really malevolent conduct? It's sort of beyond me, but
I totally agree. That one to me is even more troubling, because you can have one crazy person who tries to lead a group of others, but to have three or four who do the same thing and watch somebody die. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and as we know, there's sort of a pack mentality when it comes to those things, you know, but it doesn't excuse it at all. And it's, you know, the law is dealing with this, I think, in a pretty good way. I think that sentence was fair. And let's hope that she gets whatever help she needs. And let's hope maybe she can explain to the rest of us what she was thinking.
Well, and the greatest crime, or the greatest penalty, I suppose, is the fact she's going to live with it for the rest of her life. All right, we're way late here, but I got to ask you about this, because I know people are driving around who have had bad wedding photographer experiences. 99.9% of wedding photographers do a bang up job and all that, but sometimes people aren't happy. And a wedding photographer just made $1 million in a defamation lawsuit.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I guess the couple didn't like what happened in the photography and went on a campaign to disparage her. And what they said was false. And the jury found that there was false and there were damages, $1 million. So, you know, beware. A lot of people like to go online and badmouth restaurants and badmouth vendors. And, you know, I understand you want to do that and you want to protect other people from a bad experience, but you have to be careful in what you say, because if it's a fault, if it's an opinion, Steve, you can say whatever you want. The guy's a jerk. I don't like the pictures. But when you have false facts that go to someone's reputation, that could be actionable.
It's like when Karen goes online and says that, you know, I'm a kleptomaniac. I mean, that's not necessarily true.
Not necessarily. Yeah.
Thanks, Karen.
I can't do that because you stole my computer.
I borrowed it.
Touché.
Karen Conti hosting the Noonan Show Sunday from 6 to 9 p.m. And what's the number at the office?
312-332-7800 or kconti@kcontilaw.com.